I'm going to tell you guys about QJet, or Q Anti-KT and QJets, which is a project I've been working on with Delani Kahawala, a graduate student at Harvard, along with Matt Schwartz. And along the way, I'll also talk about work I've done with Steve Ellis, Andrew Hornick, and Tuhin Roy, and some more ongoing work with them. Here's the outline of the talk. So I didn't know the background, and if you guys look bored, I'll skip ahead through some of this. But I'll begin with a quick review of jets. Then I'll tell you guys about QJets, and then I'll show you how you can apply these both to substructure and to whole event clustering, and then some conclusions. So since Itai's in the audience, I'll try to go slowly. But if anyone has any questions, just let me know. Like, a lot of the stuff, especially the statistics, can be counterintuitive, and I'd be happy to explain it. But in case you have limited attention span, like Itai, I'll just give you the takeaway. So we use lots of jet algorithms at the LHC, like Anti-KT, Cambridge, and KT. And they're all great. They're all, they've been developed for a long time. But each of these things only gives you a single interpretation of an event or of jet substructure. So I take an event, I run Anti-KT on it. That just gives me a single picture of that event. And we're saying this is that you can actually do better by considering many interpretations of the event at once. So not just anti-KT, but interpretations of the event like that. By doing this, you get weighted events. So instead of each event either counting as signal-like or not signal-like, it counts as signal-like to some degree. And by importing weighted events and being smart about your statistics, you can instantly realize these useful gains in whatever it is you're looking to measure, like your signal-to-background ratio or you're single to uncertainty in background. So yeah, the basic message is don't just take a single view of an event, take multiple views, get better statistics, and you'll do better without much effort on pretty much any collider study. So now I'll give you guys a review. So at the LHC, jets are very important. I don't think I need to tell this crowd that. And there are two basic types of jets. There are the sequential recombination jets and cone algorithms. Cone algorithms are what people used at the Tevatron, and these are things like, which basically stamp out cookie cutter-like jets from your event. On the other hand, all the modern jet algorithms are sequential recombination algorithms, which make jets by assembling pieces one by one by one. So I'll tell you guys about those. How do these things work? So basically what happens is you define a so-called metric, which is a distance between any two form momenta in your event. So you turn on your LHC, you get 100 different particles in the event. Between every pair of particles, you define a distance, dij, and for every particle individually, you define another distance. I'll give you guys an example of these in a second. But what basically happens is you compute all these distances between the particles, then you find the smallest one. And then, so if I have 5 particles and I see that 2 of them are close together according to this metric, I merge them together. And then I repeat this process many, many times, and in this way I build up my jets. So just to illustrate that, suppose I have a very simple event at the LHC where I get 4 particles, I compute all these distances, so 1, 2, 1, 3, 2, 3, and all these things between to jet 4. Let's say the smallest distance happened to be this guy, so I take those 2 particles, merge them together, I get a new jet, repeat the process. Say these guys are closest together, I merge them together, make a new jet, and then so on. So I went from 4 jets to 2 jets. That's how these sequential recombinations, which we use all the time at the LHC, work. Here are the customary metrics. So there's the KT algorithm, which was used more at the Tevatron, which says that 2 guys are close together when one of them is very soft, and when they're close together by angle. There's the Cambridge algorithm, which says that 2 guys are close together when they're close together in angle. And then there's the anti-KT algorithm, which says that 2 guys are close together when one guy is really hard and when they're close together in angle. So by using these different characteristic distances, we can get different jet clustering behaviors. And very heuristically, anti-KT clusters from hard to soft. So if this is a hard jet, it'll make a nice circle around it, and then it'll cluster the softer one. Cambridge kind of splits the difference, and KT starts with the softer one and then goes to the harder one. And just to kind of,
One question about the previous slide.
This one?
Actually, the previous one. what's the intuition about, like, why can you not have two very soft things very close to each other? Like, you don't get an additional. What's the intuition for just taking the minimum and not something more complicated function? You can imagine just, you know, multiplying by the product of PT times PT.
Yeah, you could. I think these are nice because, so you stop clustering when this guy is smaller than this guy. And because this thing only involves a single PT, it's nice, this has a well-defined radial behavior. Like, there are three different comparisons when I'm looking to see whether I should either stop merging, I should continue merging, or stop. There's DIB, DJB, and DIJ. So if this was some weird product, then it might have weird behavior. Does that answer your question?
Of course not. No.
Okay.
Have there been any studies on trying to do something a little more continuous, let's say, than minimum?
Not to my knowledge. I mean, you could also try playing with this power here to interpolate between the two. And that's something people have suggested. I hope to convince you by the end that what you should, if you're trying to do that, you should really try to do that with QJets. Like,
well, it goes along the line of what you suggested at the very beginning, which is very nice. That, you know, you should try to look as many interpretations as you can.
Yeah.
And that would be one way of adding to the statistical interpretations you have.
That's right. No, I think that's good. And I mean, people have mentioned this. They haven't mentioned your product idea, but it'd be interesting to look at it.
I won't. But
well, I try to be polite. For anti-KT?
Yeah. At least I seem to remember some argument along these, but I don't know.
So from a perturbative QCD point of view, the anti-KT is...
I could imagine that being true for KT, but and for Cambridge, but because it, in the limit where there's like a hard guy and a soft guy, only the distance to the soft guy would matter. For anti-KT, I'm not sure.
Yeah. My naive question here would be, these algorithms, I mean, you look at them and they're very simple, that's part of their appeal. But I'm wondering, because we have truth-level information available, at least at the parameter level, even at the perturbative QCD level, I wonder if there's, I mean, of course, part of this is what you're doing, but if there's been like a single optimal algorithm that's been determined to actually the most correctly mimic the physics that goes with the parameter channel.
So
been like
So Mike Spanovsky and Dave Soper tried to do this.
Is this the Shaab deconstruction?
Yeah. It's a really interesting idea, but it's hard because you need to come up with a very accurate model of it. And what winds up happening is you have to make a simplified model of it.
Right. Okay.
But yeah, so everything you guys have mentioned is like a reasonable idea, I think. Maybe not.
Thank you.
So, there are different trade-offs for using these different algorithms. The nice thing about anti-KT is that it gives you, by starting at the hard pieces of radiation and working outward, it gives you nice conical jets. So the area is very well behaved, which is good for things like calibration. You kind of know how much soft crap has gone into the jet. The problem is that, you know, as David is alluding to, the ordering of the shower has, you know, little physical significance. The last guy added onto it is just going to be some soft parton towards the side of the jet. In contrast, you know, KT and Cambridge cluster from near to far and soft to hard, which allows us to think about parton shower heuristics. So they kind of have some behavior. If I'm clustering a jet, then like a jet with substructure, then usually the last merging is going to correspond to the hard splitting. So these guys have a physical ordering, but on the problem they can have perverse shapes in weird areas. So the point just to take away from this is that there are different algorithms which have different strengths, and ideally you kind of want to mix them together. So Let me tell you guys now about QGIS for JIT substructure. So this part, again, is a little bit of a review, just in case you're unfamiliar with substructure. So the cool thing about the LHC is that the particles which are really important to our study of ESM physics, W, Z, Topp, and Higgs, have a mass which is an order of magnitude below the collision energy. So I'm producing particles of order, 100 or so GeV divided by TeV down here. So R here is the opening angle in the decay between the decay products of a boosted particle, which means that the opening angle between, say, a boosted Higgs or Topp or W or Z, et cetera, at LHC energies where we hope to see new physics, is going to be small. This could be 0.1, 0.2, et cetera. And typical jet sizes are usually 0.6, 0.7. So at the LHC, as we go to higher and higher energies, these cool particles which we need to understand to look for new physics are going to be clustered entirely inside of the same jet. So this is like my 2-second motivation of jet substructure. So you can see that over here, here's a top on the top, or here's a top pair on the top at with a PT of 100 JeV decaying to two widely separated jets. But as soon as I give this thing gets a PT of energy, then these guys go entirely inside of the same jet. So the name of the game in jet substructure is kind of distinguishing this from the jet from a light parton, like a quark or gluon. I don't know. I just stole these slides, and this is power, and this is just keynote circles. What? So it's a problem, and a lot of work in this field over the past couple of years has been on how you distinguish these things. How do you distinguish, say, boosted WZ Topp or Higgs from an ordinary boosted parton? And there are and the cool thing that people have discovered is that not only can you do this, but in some ways you can make your analyses better. Not only can you recover particles which you would have lost, but in going to boosted QC into these boosted regimes, you can reduce backgrounds. So that's what you're trying to do, and it can actually be useful. What are the tools that you have? Well, QCD jets look really different from the jets of boosted heavy objects. The first thing that you notice is that boosted heavy objects don't have these kind of soft these soft singularities. If I give you a W and I boost it, then the energy of its two subjects, of its two decay products, are going to be roughly the same order. So if I have a W and I give it a TeV of energy, each quark coming off of it is going to have roughly 500 JeV. In contrast, QCD has these soft singularities, which say that if I start with a gluon and it splits into two gluons, one of those gluons is likely to be soft. So here, these are the so-called Otterelli-Parisi splitting functions. Z is the energy fraction of one of these two gluons, so you can see there are singularities when that becomes small. So just to show you in pictures here, if I have, say, a boosted Higgs decaying into say, BB bar, it's going to give me two different subjects, each with roughly an equal amount of energy, or PT. Whereas if I have a QCD jet splitting, which is decaying into some region of the detector, there's going to be some hierarchy to the emissions. So first we'll have, say, maybe a gluon here, then a softer gluon here, and an even softer gluon here, et cetera. This thing has a single hard splitting. There's no splitting here.
Wouldn't the more interesting comparison be between the left side and, say, the gluon splitting into three bar?
So, so if the gluon splits into BB bar, there's no soft singularity. So that's harder. Well, this is like, if I'm just at the zeroth order level, I'm doing, then, and I don't do B tagging. Like if I have a boosted W or something, then this would be like the first thing you'd want to distinguish. But, you've been reading ahead.
No, sorry.
No, it's good. More than I expect.
I don't
read your papers, so. So that's the first tool you can use. You can kind of look at the structure of the radiation to see whether there's a hard splitting or not. And then the second thing, which is going more towards what Itai is saying, is you can look at things like the mass. So if a gluon can split into BB bar, there is no soft singularity there. In that case, you want to make sure you get the mass of the jet really correct, because there's no reason for that gluon to be sitting at 126 GeV. So the first tool in your toolbox is like the properties of the radiation. The second one is getting like things like jet mass really correct. And there, in the past, there have been two different approaches to this. The first one is to try to look at the two-dimensional distribution of energy that you've measured to see, does it look, say, two-pronged, or does it look three-pronged, et cetera. That's n sub jettiness. You can also use trimming and filtering to try to make use of the two-dimensional distribution of radiation. But a whole other set of approaches, which is the type we'll be interested in here, is to try to associate a tree to a jet. So you take the energy measured in your calorimeter, and you build up a tree structure in it, in analogy to what you do, what would happen in a parton shower. And then you can modify this tree, and you can create observables from it. So the example I'm going to be talking about here is jet pruning. And I'll explain what that is later. But the basic idea is that we're going to take our radiation inside of our jet, make a tree out of it, and then deduce something from that. And if you think about it, there's kind of an immediate problem. If I give you a tree, if I say, here was a gluon, which split into two gluons, which then split into other gluons, you can tell me what I should see in my calorimeter. You can tell me I'll see this. So this is an onto map, or I don't know the math terminology, something like that. On the other hand, I can't really go in the other direction. If I just give you some radiation, you can't go directly onto a tree. There could be many trees which you could associate with this, so there's a question mark there. So what I'm going to argue is that in the past, all these studies have been kind of making a best choice to do this. They've been saying, okay, here's my radiation, I need to get a tree from that, I'm going to use the tree which I get from using the Cambridge-Aachen algorithm or the KT algorithm. But that's really a non-optimal choice. So why do they do that? You kind of pick a best algorithm because you expect that regardless of what you pick, you're going to get a similar answer. You expect that if you're looking at, say, the jet mass which you obtain from running pruning on a tree, you're going to get a similar answer to the jet mass you would get if that tree had been formed, you know, either with Cambridge or with KT. So does this make sense? You're kind of making an arbitrary choice, and you're hoping that it doesn't matter that much. But what you find whenever you do jet substructure studies is that actually this arbitrary choice does matter a lot. If I take some radiation in my detector and I look at the tree which I would get from Cambridge-Aachen, and I look at the pruned mass, I'll explain what pruning is in a second, maybe I would get this, and it would not look like a signal. On the other hand, I could use the equally well physically motivated KT mass, KT tree, and get a mass over here, which maybe it would look like signal. So you're kind of forcing yourself to make an arbitrary choice, and you're opening yourself up to this ambiguity.
So does this problem persist if you know you're working with a sample that's mostly, say, QCD or mostly some new kind of particle?
You mean, is this ambiguity worse?
Yeah.
Yes, and I'll come to that later. That's actually important, because what you can do is you can measure the degree of ambiguity, and you can cut on that. But no, that's good. So just from these two slides, what you should take away is that intuitively, you want to treat something. If this is what you saw, if everything is telling you this thing looks like a W, the KT tree, the Cambridge tree, et cetera, then the chance that it's a W is probably higher than if this is what's going on, where it only looks W-like under a certain number of interpretations. So I hope to show you how you can take that into account. The solution is that you're going to sum over trees. You're going to look at all the different physically plausible trees you could assign to this jet and sum over them. So what's going to happen is, let's say I have 100 different jets, and I look at their pruned mass, and I get the distribution of these masses, and the distribution of these masses looks like this. So you can see it's kind of jagged over here and jagged over here. What we're going to do instead is take 100 different interpretations of each jet and histogram them together and get something like this. And what I hope to convince you of is that the statistics of this distribution are better than the statistics of this distribution. The uncertainties are much smaller over here than over here. You look suspicious.
Well, it's not clear that you can really discuss statistics in a rigorous way when you have that, because you don't know exactly what the correlation is.
So,
like here, if you when you talk about the statistics of a single bean, right? For
yeah.
Example, you know that it's square root by basically the number of events.
Mm-hmm.
That's no longer true here because there are correlations between the way you find the
But I think the correlation is a good point, because I think the idea is that if you start with a single algorithm, you have a way of one, and you just put that every bit. Whereas if you have 10 algorithms and they all give the same mass, then they all add up to way one, and it's the same thing. So the idea is that if you, I would imagine that if you have several algorithms and they all get the same answer, you end up with what you would have ended up before. So the idea is not to upvalue certain events, it's to downvalue events, I would imagine, where the mass that you get out is ambiguous. So you, so those who then contribute. You know, you devalue certain events.
That's all good and fine, but how do you define your error bars?
Well, so
for error bars, you need the correlation between those different things.
You seem disinclined to trust me.
Of course, I don't trust you. I'm taking it for granted.
But so what we've done is we've worked out the statistics for how you actually account for this. What we're going to do is we're going to define a wide bin here, and we're going to talk about the variance in the count of that bin using weighted events. If, you're right, if we were doing a bin-to-bin correlation, then it would be subtle, because Poisson errors are governing part of it, sampling errors are governing a different part, and it's a mess. But what we're going to do is we're going to define a single bin here and look at the size at the error bars like this. Rest easy, Eitan. So just to make sure everyone's on the same page, this is what's going on. Instead of taking a single mass for each event, instead we're getting a distribution of masses for each event, like this or this or this, and we're going to sum them up and make a single distribution. That was what's happening on the other side, on the previous slide.
Like each of those figures correspond a different way of your jet algorithm.
So
each of these figures one event.
So this will be like jet one, and this will be like anti-KT and KT. So let me quickly tell you guys what we're going to do to get these different trees. So intuitively, it makes sense that KT is a physically motivated algorithm. Cambridge is a physically motivated algorithm. But so we would want these guys to count with a high weight, because they're kind of inverting the parton shower. In contrast, if I just do something completely random, if I put together a tree in some random order, I would want it to count with low weight. So what we want to do is we kind of want to sample trees in proportion to their to the physical motivation of their algorithm. And, you're raising your hand.
So just a continuing question. So when you say you want to count different trees, what do you find jets with, say, Cambridge Akin, and then take each jet and recluster a billion times, or do you take the whole event and recluster a billion times?
So
because random reclustering the events is the same, but randomly reclustering a single predefined jet seems less insane.
So the second half of the talk is insane. Where we're going to cluster like the whole event many times. Not completely. So, all right. So this is a good point. If we were to assemble every single jet, every single combination, it would be insane. But what we're going to do is we're going to do Monte Carlo sampling. We're going to like sample trees, and we're going to kind of deviate from the KT or Cambridge or anti-KT path. So we're going to be doing some kind of important sampling. So it's not that insane.
But you always consider the whole event.
So in the first part, I'm going to assume we got a nice kosher jet from anti-KT, and then we're going to rerun the inside. We're going to rerun the constituents of that. In the second half, we're going to do the whole event.
Okay.
So how does this important sampling work? I showed you in the first half of the talk how standard algorithms work. You take these metrics, these DIJs, which tell you the order in which the jet should be assembled, and you find the smallest one, merge that together, repeat. But now, instead of finding the smallest one, we're going to take one in proportion to a weight. So we're going to define the weight for each different pair to be alpha, which is some parameter, times DIJ over DIJ min, which means that the smallest DIJ has a high weight, the largest DIJ has a very small weight. So we're going to be sampling trees in proportion to how much they're similar they are to, like, the KT tree or the Cambridge Akin tree.
Wait, sorry. So is there a different omega ij for each kind of jet algorithm, or is there just one omega distribution?
That's a good question. So We use KT or Cambridge to get these DIJs. And then from that, we get these omegas. So there would be a different omega if we used a different one here. In practice, though, as soon as you get alpha to be small enough, these distributions tend to look really close to each other. So the set of omegas I get from KT actually looks very similar to the set I get from Cambridge. So we get these weights, we merge a pair in proportion to its weight, and then we repeat this procedure 100 different times to sample jets in proportion to how close they are to these paths.
So the omega is just there to help you define what the weight is.
That's right. Yeah, so algorithm goes in here, this is just the weight. The result is that you get many, many trees, and the probability of finding a tree becomes less as it deviates from these KT or Cambridge behaviors. This is actually available as a FastJet plugin, which you can download here, and hopefully it will not crash. We actually haven't had any complaints yet, but the point is that you can actually run this right now if you want. You might be worried about something about IR and collinear safety. So IR collinear safety means that QCD has soft and collinear singularities, which means that if I'm doing a calculation, I don't want to make myself sensitive to a very soft emission. If I have a two-jet event and I have an infinitely soft gluon landing somewhere else, I don't want to consider that to be a three-jet event or a four-jet event. I want to make sure that this is still a two-jet event. So IR collinear safety means that an infinitely collinear splitting of a parton gives you the same result. And in the addition or subtraction of an infinitely soft piece of radiation gives you the same result. So anti-KT and KT and Cambridge are all IRC safe. And QJETS is too, as long as alpha is not equal to 0. To see that, you have to note that when I have a pair of jets which gets infinitely close together, their DIJ approaches 0, which means that every other DIJ has an infinitely small weight compared to that. And in the same way, And by the nature of sequential recombination algorithms where you just add things together, any soft emission can't change the result. So this might be a technical point, but these are sane algorithms to run, is all I wanted to say. So now I'm going to tell you guys about the statistics, which is I think the most fun part. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to, instead of saying each event is either signal-like or not signal-like, instead we're going to say it's signal-like to some degree. So how does that work? You get an event. This is an event. You define some mass window, and you just say how many of these 100 interpretations landed in that mass window. And then I take the integral of the curve in that mass window, and I say that that's the weight. So if 30 of my interpretations landed in my W mass window, I say the W likeness of this jet is 0.3. So now comes the statistics. So let's just remind ourselves how statistics normally work. Normally, I produce events, and the production is subject to is a Poisson process. So there's some uncertainty which goes as the square root of the number of events. Then I reconstruct these events, and I either reconstruct them as signal-like or not, with some efficiency, which I'm going to call epsilon. The final fractional uncertainty in the expected number of events is 1 over square root of epsilon times n. And this is what everyone's been doing all along. If I give you 200, if I say that you should expect to produce 200 events reconstructed with efficiency 0.5, the variance, the characteristic uncertainty in the number of events you're going to reconstruct is root 100. So that's what we normally do. But what I hope to convince you of now is that instead of being 1 over root 100, it can lie, if we use weighted events, anywhere in the range 1 over root epsilon n to 1 over root n. So you're bounded, your uncertainty is bounded by Poisson statistics, but now you no longer have as much uncertainty coming from the reconstruction. So this is a technical slide, and I promise it's the last one with this many equations. But I'll try to go through it. So normally what happens is that if we're in a collider, we produce events subject to some Poisson subject to some Poisson distribution. That's at the top. And then we reconstruct them. And the reconstruction is a binomial process, which means that each event is either signal-like or not. And the cool thing is that the convolution of a Poisson process and a binomial process is a Poisson process. So that's how. That's why whatever what we normally do when we take when we say the uncertainty is the square root of the number of events is still works. There's all this complicated stuff with Poisson processes and sampling processes going on in the background, but it's still okay to do. With QJETs, what happens is I produce events, and their production, the number of events produced, is subject to a Poisson process. But now I assign each of these things a weight, and I can talk about the density of the weights. So here. This says, I expect to produce n events. I produce a of them. And then this should, no, I produce, I expect to, yeah, this should be an a. I expect to produce, I have a events. I reconstruct nr of them. So now I'm kind of looking at the distribution of weights. And what winds up happening is if I look at the variance of this.
What tells you on the right? So above, what tells you that you will end up with x events is that you're populating against v,
yes.
Which is x given that you had a and epsilon. Where does x appear on
f? This should be an x and this should be an a. You didn't know that?
So
so here, let me just forward this.
No, actually, I don't agree with you. That's not x and that's a. Because you integrate over.
So I'm integrating. Let's see. Where did this formula come from? So epsilon here is the is integral over f, right? Epsilon is the expected efficiency for reconstructing these things.
Yeah. But what is sigma 1?
So sigma 1 is the variance of these weighted distributions.
Right.
So let me just show this to you quickly. So these are what the f's look like. F is like the distribution of weights, how signal-like it is. So normally, it's either 0 or 1, but now it's going to be some distribution in between 0 or 1. So sigma 1 is the variance of that distribution.
So that was a distribution for a single event, but just different interpretations of that same
event. So it's a distribution over many events. So I take one event. 30 of the 100 reconstructions look signal-like. Then I bin 0.3 here. I take another event, and then I bin over here. So this is what it would look like over in a very large sample. So it's the distribution of weights. And you can kind of see why this should help you. Over here, an event is either signal-like or background-like. But when I look at all these events, I can see, well, really none of them are always going to be signal-like. Some of them are like. Most of them are only signal-like some fraction of the time. So the net result is that I still have this 1 over n here coming from the Poisson statistics. But now I have this, instead of having 1 over root epsilon, I have this 1 plus sigma 1 squared over epsilon squared. Are you happy with it? Because if you're not, this is important.
We can go over it.
Okay.
But so basically, what you're trying to say is that, you know, if I use only one JET algorithm, then whatever the efficiency is, that determines for me the 1 over square root epsilon n.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's it. But if I have several JET algorithms, some of them might be much more efficient. Epsilon could be 1. Right? And so if you use that JET algorithm, if you weigh in, that will bring you down.
If you had such an algorithm with epsilon equals n, epsilon equals 1, then you should just use that one.
No, but I think your point is that different algorithms may have epsilon equal to 1 depending on what event it is.
Yeah.
And so by using several together, you're always guaranteeing that you're having the best one choosing determining your epsilon. It's like taking a weighted sum, right? The one with the least the one with the least error bar end up dominating your statistics. And so here, for any event, the JET algorithm with the least with the highest efficiency will dominate your distributions. And you're basically weighing them.
I don't think that's fair. I don't think that's what's happening. I think each one. Suppose this is what's happening. Suppose each algorithm knew whether it was signal-like or not, and then flipped a coin. So then epsilon is going to be 0.5 for each one. But it's essentially making a completely arbitrary choice. What you'd like to do in that, if you had these algorithms, was run 1,000 of them. Then each one's going to, then you know that if it's signal-like, it's going to be roughly 0.5. Is that what you're saying?
No.
I don't want to talk past you.
Yeah,
okay. But so just so you guys know, this is something insane to do. If these F distributions, which I showed on the previous slide, on the next slide, have assumed this form of a delta function over here and a delta function over here, then this thing reduces to the above formula. So it's a completely sane thing to do, except this number can be smaller than that number. So how do you get these? So how do you deal with this? Because you have these weird f's now, these weird weighted functions. It turns out that all you really need on the previous slide is the variance of these things and their average efficiency. So you can obtain these properties of f by using Monte Carlo simulations. You take, if you're interested in reconstructing boosted W jets, you'll take 1,000 different jets, reconstruct each of them 100 different times, and then you can derive the variance and the efficiency from that sample. And we're putting, the original paper we wrote was in PRL, so it's completely impenetrable. So we're going to write it. We have a formal discussion coming out soon, which hopefully should clarify a lot of these statistical points. OK. So let me just show you. Now let me get into the fun part where we talk about how these things are used. So suppose we're looking at boosted W jets with jet pruning, and we want to measure various properties of that. How does pruning work? So what pruning basically does is it says, take a jet, look at all the calorimeter cells, make a tree from that. Then remove each part of the tree which has a wide angle soft emission. Basically, you want to remove every part of the tree which looks really QCD-like. Or which has a wide-angle soft emission, because we would expect that if we're looking at a boosted W, all the wide-angle emissions are going to be coming from the hard decay. They're not going to be soft. And therefore, what pruning does is it basically does two things. The first thing it does is it improves the mass of signal jets. It's going to remove all the soft crap around the side of the jet, so it's going to make the W mass resolution a lot better. The second thing it does is it kind of guts QCD jets, so it lowers the background. In practice, this is what's happening. You have your calorimeter, you measure all these different emissions from it, you build up your tree according to Cambridge, according to Cambridge or KT, and then you just remove all parts of that tree which are wide angle and soft. So hopefully, if this was like a boosted W, I'm just going to get the two hard W decay products and all this soft crap along the sides, which probably came from ISR or pile up or multiple emissions, is going to be removed. In contrast, if I have like a QCD jet which has a hard center and diffuse stuff around the side, I'm just going to remove that and shred the mass.
What's the effect of
I think the Z cut, which is like the ratio of the energies, is 0.1 or so. So if this guy has less than 10% of the energy of the hard core here, then I throw it out. And And the Angular cut is set on, it's set event by event, I think. I don't offhand remember the formulation of it, but it basically allows, it allows little subjects here, but then everything a little further away gets removed.
Can I ask another question? So
yes.
if we had, I mean, this is a very general question, like, for any browser. So if I had a left compiler without any entering activity before the collision, so to speak, and then I had a perfect detector that detected all the energy perfectly, then you would never do anything like pruning, presumably, because all the hadronic activity is genuine in the sense that you want it because it's part of the parton that you created, so, right?
Well, it would remove half the motivation for pruning. So it won't improve the mass of signal particles in that case, but it would help you remove spurious QCD. So if I have like a gluon with lots of, with many other emissions, and it happens to have a mass around 80 GeV,
right,
it's going to reduce that guy's mass to like 20 GeV.
I mean, theoretically though, if I had just a particle flying off and then it showers and hadronizes, and I'm catching all of its products,
yes,
then this thing's mass should give me the original particle mass.
But you don't always want that, right?
Right.
If the particle was from QCD, you don't want that because that's not your signal. So you want a way to just get rid of high mass QCD stuff.
Sure.
You're thinking about the half of the thing that it does, which has to do with the wide angle.
It's a very general question.
Okay, we can talk about it later, maybe. So here's half the motivation.
You have a lot to explain later, sir.
So here's half the motivation where you can improve the mass resolution of Busa tops. But let me just go on. So let's see what happens when we run this with the QJETS procedure. So now instead of just taking the KT tree and pruning it, we're going to take many trees, prune them many times, and hopefully get a more stable result. So let me just go fast through this. I'll show you the cool parts. So let's say we're interested in signal discovery, where we have a set of boosted Ws, and we have a continuous background from QCD. Now, so this would be the normal set of boosted Ws. The Ws are up there, the QCD is down here. We're going to go from a distribution which looks like that on the left to a distribution which looks like that on the right. So you can kind of see by eye that things are getting a little bit more stable. We're going to use a window between, 70 and 90 GeV, and we're basically going to be looking at the characteristic fluctuations. Our metric is going to be the size of the signal divided by the size of the characteristic background fluctuations. So that's why we normally use S over root B. Here we have to modify it to use our weighted statistics. So what you find is that if I look at the size of the improvement in this metric compared to standard classical to a classical algorithm, you can see up to an 18% improvement. This, I think, it doesn't sound like much, but so this is the number which you normally want to be 5 sigma. If you can get to 5 sigma, 20% earlier, you've saved yourself quite a bit of luminosity, because this thing scales as the square root of luminosity. And later I'll present even better results. But the basic idea is that you can make a measurement with the same amount of accuracy as you normally could by using these weighted events with significantly less LHC runtime. And let me skip past this a second. This was the signal to background discrimination, which I think Gordon was asking about. What you can do is you can look at the variation in the interpretations of the jet and use that as a signal to background discriminant. Because a single jet is pretty much always going to be, if it's really coming from a hard QC, from a hard splitting like a decay of a W, pretty much all the time it's going to look like a single jet. On the other hand, maybe a particular QCD background jet looked signal-like under KT, but then won't look signal-like under Cambridge. So this is also another variable you can cut on. But let me just go quickly now. So the message, in case you haven't gotten, is that you should queue everything. anytime you're measuring something which is subject to an arbitrary choice, you shouldn't make your final observable subject to that arbitrary choice. You should consider all the different plausible interpretations and give each of them a weight. So what I showed you before was just how to apply this to JIT substructure. You take the KT algorithm and the Cambridge algorithm and you kind of perturb around them to get lots of different answers. Now what we're going to do is we're going to take the anti-KT algorithm and perturb around it to get many different interpretations of a single event. So what's going to happen now is that I run my event, my clustering algorithm one time, I get one set of four momenta, I run it another time, I get a different set of four momenta. So the four momenta of my jets now change, and also even the jet multiplicities change. And this is also available as if our paper isn't out yet. Hopefully it'll be out soon. But if you want, I can give you guys the plugin to play with. So let's first think about this in the context of diejets. Diejets are completely unambiguous, pretty much. If I show you the calorimeter display of a diejet event, it's pretty hard to misreconstruct it. Let's see how they do. So here are some colored pictures. Let me tell you guys what's going on. So we run the event 100 times, and if a particular calorimeter cell is in one of the two hardest jets all the time, it's colored blue. If it's in one of the two hardest jets, I don't know, 30, 40% of the time, it's colored green. And then if it's only rarely in one of the two hardest jets, it becomes purple colored. This is what we would see if we took a diejet event and we ran it, and we looked at it at very low alpha. So it's considering it's going kind of, so alpha, as you remember, is kind of controlling how closely you're hewing to the original algorithm. So here the algorithm is kind of doing anything it wants. As we go closer and closer and closer to the to the classical algorithm, we see that that these two hard jets, which are what we would expect from the classical algorithm, begin to take shape. So we see that, and then that, and then that. And then at alpha equals 100 or so, we see this. So this is just to give you an idea of what's going on in our reconstruction. So at alpha equals, say, 1 or 0.1, which turns out to be the optimum operating point, we have pretty much two hard jets, but it's kind of undecided about what to do with this emission in between them. Sometimes it will count it, sometimes it won't.
Is there a jet
No, not yet. That's another, that would be, I mean, we're going to mock up a Higgs analysis in even more detail, where a veto would be something really interesting to look at. As you probably know, a lot of these microjets kind of sit on the edge of the veto, right? So sometimes they're going to be in it, sometimes they're going to be out of it, and now you're going to kind of, now you're no longer as sensitive to that. So let me show you guys what happens with the more ambiguous event. So here is the calorimeter display for an event coming from the pair production of resonances. So there are four hard jets plus ISR plus multiple track.
Sorry.
Yes. Mm-hmm. You wonder if mass is stable, or?
Yeah.
I might just not understand your exact question.
I mean, you have some high PT object, right? And there is some other stuff that, with a jet veto, may fall beneath it, the jet veto, then the mass of the object changes.
Right? Whether or not that other stuff is clustered with the jet?
Yeah.
Right. So. Sometimes here you'll cluster with it, sometimes you'll throw it out. Is that
right? Right, so I'm wondering if it's stable.
It wouldn't be stable. Sometimes you would add it, sometimes you would throw it out.
We can cluster it off.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
So here's a four jet event. Plus you know, everything else, like plus ISR, plus multiple interactions. So if I just showed you this to you, you would probably have a hard time guessing what are the four hard partons. Maybe it's this, that, and this is something else, or maybe it's this, and that. It's kind of hard to see. So let's see what happens when we apply QJETs to this. This is at very low alpha, and as we go to higher and higher alpha, we see it's still pretty ambiguous. Once we get to alpha of around you know, 0.01, we're scared because, you know, for a couple of reasons. But you can see there are now 5 distinct patches of radiation in here. And it's really unclear which are the 4 hardest jets. So you can see that as I go to, at my highest alpha, these are the 4 hardest jets I'm choosing. So this is what anti-KT would choose, even though this other guy is right on the threshold. But now, at lower alpha of around 0.1 or so, a good fraction of the time that guy is being put in. And what we're arguing is that this is exactly the behavior you want. We can't. If I look at this event, I can't tell by eye what's going on. And QJets will allow you to sample all the reasonably plausible interpretations of it. So let's say my observable here is, so how would the standard Kolmogorov analysis work? I take the 5 hardest jets, or the standard analysis for the pair production of resonances. I take the 5 hardest jets, I try to find the pair, which 2 pairs which are closest to each other in mass, I plot them, and I see how often they're going to be inside of some signal window. So that's what I've done, or that's what we've done here for a particular event at different alpha. So I take the 5 hardest jets, this is, say, the lighter mass, this is the heavier mass, and then I want to see how often they're inside this window. So you can see what's happening is that at low alpha, it's completely crazy. At alpha equals 1, there are 3 different choices for how to interpret this event. It can either be 2 really heavy resonances, in which case it's not going to look signal-like, 2 lighter resonances, in which case it won't look signal-like. But there is some fraction of radiation which really seems to look signal-like here. And anti-KT is going to miss that. So this is the anti-KT result. But you see QJets is picking that up a little bit. So QJets would assign this a signal-like weight of however many circles there are in here divided by the total number of circles. And I argue that this is exactly what you want. Oftentimes, if you're doing a collider study and you look at how the event is being reconstructed, you're like, oh, if it had only picked like this little microjet towards the side of my jet, then I would have a signal event here, and my efficiency would be better. QJets allows you to do that in a statistically sane way. Oh, so you pick a single alpha, and then you sum over many different clusterings.
Okay. But what motivates the choice in alpha other than Monte Carlo?
That's pretty much it. What would be cool to do would be to apply this to like a. So you could apply this to E plus E minus scattering, and let's say I'm trying to get alpha E and M from a measurement of like. The 3-jet ratio at LEP divided by the 2-jet ratio at LEP. You could compute that normally, or you can compute that using QJets, and now you're going to get each event is going to look 3-jet-like to some degree, 2-jet-like to some degree. So from doing that, you could try to figure out what the optimum value of alpha should be.
Nice.
So in a sense, we're kind of, it's just Monte Carlo for now, but there's a way to go about calculating it, which we intend to do at some point, or hope to do. So by using Q anti-KT and being smart about your statistics, you can do a lot better than using anti-KT. I like to emphasize that you can just retrofit this onto any analysis. So any SUSY analysis, any other analysis using anti-KT can also use Q anti-KT. It helps by improving the stability of your measurement, you can make your discoveries or exclusions much faster. So in our paper, which will hopefully be out soon, we consider the pair production of resonances, in which case, you know, we fully optimize anti-KT, and then we use Q anti-KT on top of that, and we see a 50% improvement in the signal to uncertainty and background ratio, which means that you could achieve a 5 sigma discovery with less than half the luminosity, which we thought was great. You can also apply this to Higgs production, in which case, if you're looking for Higgs recoiling against the Z, you might see a 20% improvement. We're talking to some people at Atlas about using this. And the whole point of this is that as the single event which you're looking for becomes more and more ambiguous as you go from 2 jets to 4 jets to 8 jets, the QJets works better and better and better because there's more ambiguity and you're making yourself less sensitive to that. So pretty much what I was saying. You run this, you have a simple resonance production, you get, I don't know, 3-5% improvement. As you begin to recoil against a Z and PT cuts become more important, you get 20%. Pair production of scalars gives you 50%. So we were excited about this. It's slow. I mean, I wrote it. Well, the graduate student, Delani, and I wrote it. So it takes about 30 seconds to run for a full event, which isn't impossible, especially given how much, you know, effort is being spent on the LHC and on like Higgs studies, but it's not fast. But no experimentalist has said that this is going to be an obstacle. And there are also ways to make it faster by limiting mergings and pre-clustering and pre-selection, which I'd be happy to talk to you guys about. So to conclude, Q stuff is awesome. But more rigorously, whenever you use a JET algorithm to reconstruct a JET, a subjet, or an event, you're kind of making an arbitrary choice, and that sucks. Because sometimes two physically motivated algorithms can be giving you very different answers, and you shouldn't have to make yourself choose between them. Instead, what you should do is you should consider a continuum of interpretations over all physically plausible algorithms. You should use sane statistics, which we show you how to use, and then you'll instantly realize very large improvements in your signal to in your discovery metrics. You'll get 5 sigma with half the luminosity. So this is currently being implemented at Atlas and CMS, and at least for substructure. And we're hoping to get Q anti-KT adopted soon. That's it. This one?
Like when you're showing the different alphas in the M1 and M2 plots. Yeah. So with background, you imagine you're also increasing the number of jets by one. Is it just that would tend to be the softest jet, so you will populate this with low mass? Like if you do a similar kind of cube jet plot with the background, combinatorically, you might end up with something that they're just saying that predominantly will populate the slower one.
So what we're trying to say is that the fact that 30% of these interpretations landed here is better than either like one here and nothing else anywhere else. Okay. Background could have exactly the same properties and you'd still do better. Okay. Which is very counterintuitive, but you can show it. Yeah. So this is all statistics at this point.
How about, since there are quite a lot of questions already, for those who want to leave, let's thank David again. And,
thanks.